Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. We have made it to the end of another year, and it's time for Southbound's Best of 2024. In this episode, you'll hear excerpts of my conversations with YouTube star Landon Bryant, political writer Michael Cruz, college football reporter David Hale, and a host of authors, Valerie Borlein, Disha Filya, Kiese Lehman, and James Lee Burke. I'm eternally grateful to get to talk to so many interesting Southerners, especially in a year that brought so many changes to the South and to the whole country. Talking to smart people helps me navigate the world a little better. And I hope listening to these excerpts does the same for you. If you're interested in listening to the full episodes with these guests or any others, all 180-some episodes of Southbound are available at wfae.org/southbound. You can also find our recent episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, and pretty much wherever you get podcasts. Let's start today's episode with Landon Bryant, who's taken the old Southern storytelling tradition and given it an online twist. Landon translates the language and etiquette of the South in viral clips that have made him a star on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. In this clip, Landon talks about a crucial aspect of Southern socializing: what to do when it's time to go home. So let's say you've been visiting somebody's house and you've been there a while and it's getting time to leave. What do you say or do to sort of start that process?
Well, it's a long process, so there's a lot of steps to it, but it starts with sort of a shift in your body posture. Well, or all right, well, and then it moves into maybe you'll stand up and maybe even sometimes you'll head to the edge of the couch instead of just the where you were, maybe head to the edge of the couch. Then you can head to like the side of the room, lean up against the molding in the door. And from there, it just depends on the organization of the house, but you probably will end up in the kitchen. We'll do a lot more goodbyes there. Then we'll maybe get to the porch from there, maybe, but that seems like we're moving pretty quickly right now. And then eventually we'll get into the driveway. And then there's a lot more goodbyes. There's a lot of hanging into the car. Even before we get in the car, we're all going to lean on the car. And then there's hanging into the car. And then you're finally will be dismissed, but people might follow you down the driveway waving and holler and watch out for deer. But you're not gone anytime soon. Just starting the initial process of leaving you've initiated a couple of hours of stuff going on. So you do need to do that well ahead of time.
And is there anything in particular that you tend to say at that moment? That's sort of the reason I ask is my friend Tim, his family is the best one that I've heard of, which is when they're starting to get ready, one of them will say, "Come on and go with us to the poorhouse."
They come on and go with us. That's something that everybody says. And I don't know where that comes from, but they will say, "Come on and go with us." I hear that all the time. Watch out for deer is a good, this is done. Like when you say watch out for deer, it's you get to go. That's the excuse.
After Donald Trump won the 2024 election, the first person I wanted to talk to was Michael Cruz. Michael lives in Davidson, North Carolina, and writes for Politico. He spent years before and during Trump's first term becoming one of the country's foremost experts on Trump. He's broadened his range of subjects since then, but in this excerpt, he talks about how this moment resonates so much with Trump's personal history. You probably studied him for several years, as much or more as anybody. So I'm wondering if you recall a moment for him that sort of resonates with this particular moment, meaning he lost at some point, and then he made a comeback. And I'm wondering if you can think of other moments in his life that those sort of things have happened, and how he acted once he had gotten back on top, basically.
Let me say something before I answer that question. It is my intention, my hope, that I do not write about Donald Trump himself in the coming 4 years anywhere close to the way I did the first 4 years he was president and the 2 years before that when he started running. I think for me, and I think for all of us in some sense, my colleagues in journalism and competitors in journalism, and also all of us as a country, as a citizenry, need to find a way to focus in some strange sense a little bit less on him. I find myself wanting to shift from who is he to who are we. I find myself wanting to not think about as much what makes him tick and think far more about why we, and now a majority, a popular vote, voted for him again. That is much more interesting and feels much more useful to me at this point. But to answer your question more directly, Donald Trump is, at this point, I think unquestionably, the most successful loser in the history of planet Earth. He's a huge fan of comebacks. He literally wrote a book, or a ghostwriter did, called The Art of the Comeback. That's a function of this incredible knack and skill he has had his entire life, well before he got into electoral politics, to lose and yet win, to turn setbacks into successes. Not quite sure when this story ran, but really, really early on, maybe right after he became president the first time, I think the headline of this piece that I wrote was something like How Trump Succeeds When He Fails, or something along those lines. He's a man who is no stranger to bankruptcy laws, no stranger to just eye-watering amounts of debt that would have been fatal to any other person and were not to him for lots of reasons. Yes, like built-in advantages, lots of money from dad, but also a developed sense of how to leverage weakness and turn it into strength, make others around him a little bit complicit. Like, you, the banks, this is your problem too. And fast forward, not to get stuck in the weeds, to his political rise. I mean, one of the things he's done, there's lots of ways to look at Trump and interpret Trump, of course, but one of the things he was able to do in his essentially at this point complete takeover of the Republican Party is make other Republicans in some sense complicit. I'm your problem now too. You need the new base I've created. You've said this about me, and now you can't say that about me. All versions of the same skill set, if that's the right way to put it. And a certain just amount of audacity to not go away, to refuse to accept a defeat. I mean, clearly, as we've seen the last handful of years, but also just sticking around. I'm not leaving. I'm not going back to Mar-a-Lago. I'm not just going to golf. I'm going to declare my candidacy in late 2022, and it's in some very real way going to make it harder for you and you and you and you to prosecute me. It's just an intuitive understanding of how to survive situations, self-created situations, by the way, that would long ago have stopped literally any other person.
The Southern family that captivated America the most over the past few years has been the Murdochs, the South Carolina rogues who, led by Alec Murdoch, left a trail of misery, fraud, and murder. Author Valerie Barline, who covers the South for the Wall Street Journal, told the family's story in her bestseller, The Devil at His Elbow. And in this clip, Valerie talks about the duality of a man-child who gained and used tremendous power. So now we come to Alec, who Interestingly, in a way I'd not understood previously to reading your book, comes across as a gifted attorney, very influential person there, but also has this sort of childlike quality about him. You talk about how he's sort of addicted to Capri Suns. He would eat Fruity Pebbles for breakfast. And how, in fact, I think an empty container of Capri Sun kind of becomes a clue in the mystery at some point. And how did you see his personality as you got to know him from the trial and from all the research you did?
Well, you know, I think we know him now as such a depraved person, really a deeply evil person. But I wanted to explore and kind of explain to people why he was able to gain so much trust, why he got so many clients, why he was there was a duality there. And particularly in Hampton, where his family was so powerful, he was the prom king at Wade Hampton High School. He was the quarterback of the football team. He dated the prettiest girl. And he was, you know, he was always this kind of, he was nice until he wasn't. And then he was spoiling for a fight often. And you're right. There was a real childlike nature to him. He was 6'4", 265 at his heaviest. He used his size kind of strategically. You never see him. If you see a picture of him, he's never face to face with a person talking to them. He's always saddled up to them with his arm around their shoulders. And he did have there was a part of him that was almost boyish. His favorite snack, like you said, he loved Fruity Pebbles with extra sugar sprinkled on top. Can you imagine? And a key voice in the book is Blanca Simpson, who was the family housekeeper for a number of years. And she kept his house stocked with strawberry milk and his favorite types of Capri Suns. Not any Capri Suns, but he liked Mountain Cooler and he liked orange pineapple. So she always made sure to have, you know, Amazon deliver, you know, like a case of them to Moselle, his home.
In some ways, as I read this book, I had some kind of, I'm not sure if the right word is admiration, just sort of grudging disbelief at Alec Murdoch's time management skills, because he had a lot of stuff going on. So let's move forward a little bit to the point at which people start dying in this story. Could you sort of explain, maybe around whenever that was, what his sort of official jobs were and what sort of scams and frauds he was running kind of behind the scenes?
You know, his day job was as a personal injury lawyer who represented poor people who had something awful happen in their life, a death or dismemberment. And in that part of the world, the Murdochs have this very popular, very successful law firm, and they specialize in wrecks, but also other types of personal injury. And he would take a case and there would be no upfront fee, but he would take 40% of whatever he was able to get. And because the law firm was so feared, the settlements would often be large. He was making better than $1 million a year in his day job and legitimate income, and many years, many times more than that. So that was that was like his official job. But it is stunning to think the amount of separate crimes and lies he was able to keep hidden for a better part of a decade. His thefts really started accelerating. He always had kind of like penny ante crimes in the early 2000s when he was starting out in the law firm. He was always, his law partners will tell you, there was always some questionable expenses on his corporate card. He was paying for his son's private school tuition or paying for a vacation. And he would get dinged for that, but mostly it was the small things. But he started stealing from his clients in earnest in the mid-2000s. He had tried to become a real estate investor, like a big wheel in real estate, like his grandfather and his father had done on the side. They had made some investments in waterfront property down and made a lot of money that way. And he wanted to do the same. And like Alec, he always was larger and bigger than anybody that came before him. So he went into real estate in a big way at the wrong time, right before the boom. He went underwater on multiple properties he invested in and had to you know, had to come up with ways to stay afloat. And that's really when he started stealing from his clients. He would tell them, "You're not going to believe how much money I got for you. I got you $1 million." And you'll be like, $1 million? That is life-changing money. But guess what? He got $3 million. So in addition to taking the 40% that he was owed, he took the delta between what he told him and what he actually got. So he kept those lies separate. He had multiple accounts running at the bank. It was fairly, he was impressive in a way for somebody who gives off sort of an aw shucks, small town lawyer feel, the amount of criming he was able to keep separate for a really long time.
And then at some point also began embezzling from his own firm.
He did. And from his own brother, he was also involved in buying copious amounts of pills.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we forgot to top that off. He was basically an opioid addict, right?
He was buying a lot of pills. And originally with the legitimate prescription, he was a college athlete, a walk-on for the football team, and he injured his knee. So he started in the early 2000s taking pills. And then as it got harder to get pills and he needed more and more, he started buying them illegally in, you know, thousands of dollars a month worth. So he was also eventually, you know, charged with trafficking, although there's not a lot of evidence that he was involved in any sort of major drug ring. He was mostly his own use, from what I understand.
So basically, we're talking about a guy who was a mess.
Oh, and we haven't even talked about his, he had multiple women that he was juggling as well and trying to conceal from his wife, Maggie, all of his lies.
When we come back, more of the best of Southbound 2024, including James Lee Burke talking about how creativity brings him closer to God.
The only activity that we actually do in the same way that God does is creation.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey, this is Tommy. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to the best of Southbound 2024. One of the biggest changes that affected Southern sports fans this year was the shakeup in the landscape of college football. Teams switched conferences, changed alliances, had funneled their seasons into a new 12-team playoff that this year included five Southern teams, if you count the two from Texas. ESPN college football writer David Hale chronicled the season through brilliant Sunday morning recaps and his work for the ACC Network. In this clip, he talks about all the ways college football defies logic. For those folks in our audience who may not be familiar with all the stuff that's been going on, can you logically explain why the Atlantic Coast Conference, which is the main conference you are familiar with, now includes teams from Cal Berkeley and Stanford, which last I looked are much closer to the Pacific Coast than the Atlantic Coast? David, how did this happen?
You know, I was talking to an athletics director, I don't know, maybe about 6 or 8 months ago, and I just sort of lamented, like, I think I might be really bad at my job. And he said, no, we all just work in a really stupid, illogical industry. And I think that is the bottom line on this. Like, to apply logic to much of any of this is an impossibility. But from a purely business sense, college sports has been what any normal business person would say is an incredibly, incredibly inefficient marketplace for a long, long time. Now, that inefficiency, I think for a lot of us, has been the beauty of how it works. Like, it's fun, like the regional rivalries and the fact that a place like Tuscaloosa, Alabama is basically the New York City, Manhattan of college football is great. And the fact that, you know, Pittsburgh and West Virginia, schools that are less than an hour and a half apart, consider themselves completely culturally different and despise each other with every fiber of their being. Like, that's the beauty of it. But from a CEO's perspective, they would say, we're leaving a lot of money on the table because of all of this. And so you have these conferences that formed in some cases 100 years ago. You know, I think all the time. So the Southeastern Conference at one point had Sewanee in it. And if Sewanee had just played the long game, they'd be cashing like $65 million checks a year to play college football. But some of those inefficiencies have worked themselves out to a point where conferences are growing, expanding, and in the Pac-12's cases, divesting. And so teams are moving all around to find more money and put themselves in a more lucrative position, particularly as it pertains to television contracts. The ACC is one of the Atlantic Coast Conference is one of those leagues that is desperately trying to find a way to make more money and to provide some stability to its long-term future, of which I would suggest no one should be particularly confident these days. And because two of their members, Clemson and Florida State, had not at the time filed lawsuits, but had pretty much like sent out like save the date invitations that we are going to file lawsuits to try and leave this league. They wanted to provide some security that if they lost members, they had a backup plan. And because the Pac-12 was being eaten alive by the Big 12 and the Big 10, there were these schools, Cal and Stanford, who said like, well, we need somewhere to go. And this is, I mean, if you want to truly understand the ridiculousness of college football and college sports in general, the ACC has two teams that are currently suing the conference in order to try and leave without having to pay a ton of money. And three teams, Cal, Stanford, and SMU, who came to the conference and said, we don't even need your money. We just want to be a part of your conference. And so they are not even taking television revenue, or at least not a full share of television revenue, to just be a part of the ACC. So you get a good view of how, like, if you were like the CEO of, you know, IBM, and then were given like a balance sheet for any college football program, even the good ones, you would say, this makes zero sense. And how do you people sleep at night?
As a writer, I soaked up every moment of the new podcast called Reckon True Stories, which features two of my favorite authors, Deesha Filyaw, author of The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, and Kiese Lehman, author of books including Heavy and Long Division. In this clip, I asked them about their advice to young people in their position, and it evolves into a conversation about how success has affected their work. Both of you have been at, either attended or taught at, like elite universities where assuming at the time you were there or are there, there aren't many people who look like you. How do you talk to students at those places about navigating that world? And what do you wish you had known when you were students of those places?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, if I knew the shit I know, I wouldn't have been exploring, you know, like I wouldn't have hit my head up against the wall. I wouldn't have gotten kicked out of college. I don't even know if I would have gone to college if I really knew what these mugs are really about from the inside. You know, I'm just saying from somebody on the inside. I do wish I had somebody around me, and this might get to conversation, might just spiral, but I wish I had somebody around me to be like, I don't have your back. Like, nobody here has your back. You know what I'm saying? When I was in college, because that was the truth. And I was, you know, I came from like, you know, Black power parents and stuff. And I'm coming to college, and college for my parents was where like they formed community. Like, I had friends, and, you know, I went to Millsaps for my first school, and, you know, was there trying to play sports and stuff. But at the end of the day, man, like, none of those professors or administrators who talked all of that shit were willing to stand up for right when it meant they could lose their jobs. And that's That's capitalism. But I just didn't even understand that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had to become a professor, get in trouble, have the administration like threaten to like kick me out for some shit I said or didn't say around the Israel-Palestine stuff when I was at Vassar, for me to realize, oh, okay, like right and wrong have nothing to do with this shit. Like nothing. And I didn't learn that till I was like 40. So I don't know. I don't know that I wish I would have known that as a kid, but I do think it's important for us to let like young people experiment in ways and protect them when they fall. And also, I got a cushy ass job and I get paid a grip. I don't want to be acting like woe is up. You know what I'm saying?
Well, okay. Well, actually, I'm glad you said that, because it leads right into the next thing I want to ask you. You know, both of y'all have obviously had some success at this gig. You know, you're making some money. You're not buying yachts, but you're making some money. And I wonder if or how that's affected your relationship with the work. Like, how has success changed the way you go to work every day?
Success? I was just talking with a friend. We were like, it's some bullshit when people say money can't buy happiness. It certainly helps. And it doesn't guarantee happiness.
You can definitely rent some happiness, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, short term. But, you know, I definitely feel like I'm freer and with, you know, and I write with less of a burden now of worrying about, like, am I going to be able to pay my rent this month? Like, I feel freer creatively because I'm not doing 51 other things to make money to buy a little bit of time to do my creative work. And so now my creative work is my work. And so not having to worry about taking care of myself or my family, that mental burden being off me frees me up in so many ways. You know, something that your question touches on is people will be like, well, there's all this pressure because when they give you a lot of money, there are all these expectations and you got to do this. And what if, and what if, and what if, and what if? And I realized that if I thought about any of that stuff, I would be so paralyzed, I'd never write.
Right.
You know, or even if it wasn't money, just the success of Church Ladies, I had people like, well, what if, you know, Church Ladies, or what if your novel isn't as successful as Church Ladies? I'm like, it may not be, because there are very few books that were as successful as Church Ladies in terms of awards. And so to me, it's like children. You know, if you have your first child, you know, we always talk about that second child is like, yikes, what the fuck were we thinking? The first child, you know, makes you think, I could do this again. And then, you know, and it would be like having a second child and being like, your first, you know, your older sibling was amazing in these ways. We now need you to be amazing in these ways. Go, you know, and you would never do that, you know, unless you're an asshole. You know, you would never do that. And so I think of the novel as like a second child. You know, she's going to be who she's going to be in the literary world, which is a different literary world than Church Ladies just 4 years ago. I think we make a mistake when we put so much pressure on the work, whether it's a book or an essay, to be anything other than what it is. You know, that whole thing you were saying, Tommy, about the student who's like, I'm writing this because I've got a score to settle, and this is going to be or the other way around, this is going to be the thing that gets my father to be proud of me. And I tell people all the time, you cannot put that kind of burden on a piece of writing.
Our last clip today is from James Lee Burke, author of the perennially best-selling thrillers featuring his grizzled Louisiana detective, Dave Robichaux. Burke turned 88 years old in early December, but he still writes every day. And so at the end of our conversation, I asked him about, well, endings. Your series of books can obviously go on as long as the writer wants them to. But I think, you know, when you think of TV series or something like that, you sort of start thinking about endings. And I wonder if you've ever thought about or considered how you might want the Dave Robichaux series to end.
It's not going to end. It's still an end. It's like, it's just, you don't end. It doesn't end. Okay, this is what I believe, and it's metaphysical, that the one... maybe there might be more than one category here, but for what I've seen, that the only activity that we actually do in the same way that God does is creation. That's it. It's like a baptismal fount. Once you do that, you step into infinity. It has no end. Age takes its it can be hard sometimes, right? But that doesn't, I think, take away from our talent. If you've done it before, you can do it again. You can do it in a library. You can talk to it. Doesn't matter. But once you've joined that group, you're in, brother. You're in the kingdom. Why give it up?
That's the best of Southbound 2024. Thanks to all of you who listened to this episode and any of the other episodes we've done over these past 7 years. It has been a great ride, and I plan on staying on this horse as long as possible. I want to thank all the folks at WFAE who helped create, edit, and produce Southbound. I'd especially like to thank Lisa Worf, who has been an excellent editor and a kind and thoughtful colleague for many years. We'll be back in your feed on January 1st with a fresh episode, and we look forward to giving you many more in the new year. Have a great holiday season, y'all. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Worf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.